This is Audible.
The Antidote: Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. Written and read by Oliver Berkman. Chapter 1: On Trying Too Hard to Be Happy. Try to pose for yourself this task, not to think of a polar bear, and you will see that the cursed thing will come to mind every minute. Fyodor Dostoevsky, Winter Notes on Summer Impressions. The man who claims that he is about to tell me the secret of human happiness is 83 years old, with an alarming orange tan that does nothing to enhance his credibility. It's just after 8 o'clock on a December morning in a darkened basketball stadium on the outskirts of San Antonio in Texas, and according to the orange man, I'm about to learn the one thing that will change your life forever. I'm skeptical, but not as much as I might normally be, because I am only one of more than 15,000 people at Get Motivated, America's most popular business motivational seminar, and the enthusiasm of my fellow audience members is starting to become infectious. "So, you want to know?" asks the octogenarian, who is Dr. Robert H. Schuller, veteran self-help guru, author of more than 35 books on the power of positive thinking, and in his other job, the founding pastor of the largest church in the United States, constructed entirely out of glass. The crowd roars its assent. Easily embarrassed British people like me do not, generally speaking, roar our assent at motivational seminars in Texas basketball stadiums, but the atmosphere partially overpowers my reticence. I roar quietly. "Here it is, then," Dr. Schuller declares, stiffly pacing the stage, which is decorated with two enormous banners reading Motivate and Succeed, 17 American flags and a large number of potted plants. "Here's the thing that will change your life forever." Then he barks a single syllable, "Cut," and leaves a dramatic pause before completing his sentence. "The word impossible out of your life. Cut it out. Cut it out forever." The audience combusts. I can't help feeling underwhelmed, but then I probably shouldn't have expected anything different from Get Motivated, an event at which the sheer power of positivity counts for everything. "You are the master of your destiny," Schuller goes on. "Think big and dream bigger. Resurrect your abandoned hope. Positive thinking works in every area of life." The logic of Schuller's philosophy, which is the doctrine of positive thinking at its most distilled, isn't exactly complex. Decide to think happy and successful thoughts, banish the spectres of sadness and failure, and happiness and success will follow. It could be argued that not every speaker listed in the glossy brochure for today's seminar provides uncontroversial evidence in support of this outlook. The keynote speech is to be delivered in a few hours' time by George W. Bush, a president far from universally viewed as successful. But if you voiced this objection to Dr. Schuller, he would probably dismiss it as negativity thinking. To criticize the power of positivity is to demonstrate that you haven't really grasped it at all. If you had, you'd stop grumbling about such things, and indeed about anything else. The organizers of Get Motivated describe it as a motivational seminar, but that phrase, with its suggestion of minor league life coaches giving speeches in dingy hotel ballrooms, hardly captures the scale and grandiosity of the thing. Staged roughly once a month in cities across North America, it sits at the summit of the global industry of positive thinking and boasts an impressive roster of celebrity speakers. Mikhail Gorbachev and Rudy Giuliani are among the regulars, as are General Colin Powell and, somewhat incongruously, William Shatner. Should it ever occur to you that a formerly prominent figure in world politics, or William Shatner, has been keeping an inexplicably low profile in recent months, there's a good chance you'll find him or her at Get Motivated, preaching the gospel of optimism. As befits such celebrity, there's nothing dingy about the staging either, which features banks of swooping spotlights, sound systems pumping out rock anthems, and expensive pyrotechnics. Each speaker is welcomed to the stage amid showers of sparks and puffs of smoke. These special effects help propel the audience to ever higher altitudes of excitement, though it also doesn't hurt that for many of them, a trip to Get Motivated means an extra day off work. Many employers classify it as job training. Even the United States military, where training usually means something more rigorous, endorses this view. In San Antonio, scores of the stadium's seats are occupied by uniformed soldiers from the local army base. Technically, I'm here undercover. Tamara Lowe, the self-described world's number one female motivational speaker, who along with her husband runs the company behind Get Motivated, has been accused of denying access to reporters, a tribe notoriously prone to negativity thinking. Lowe denies the charge, but out of caution, I've been describing myself as a self-employed businessman, a tactic, I'm realizing too late, that only makes me sound shifty. I needn't have bothered with subterfuge anyway, it turns out, since I'm much too far away from the stage for the security staff to be able to see me scribbling in my notebook. My seat is described on my ticket as premier seating, but this turns out to be another case of positivity run amok. At Get Motivated, there is only premier seating, executive seating, and VIP seating. In reality, mine is up in the nosebleed section. It's a hard plastic perch, painful on the buttocks. But I'm grateful for it, because it means that by chance I'm seated next to a man who, as far as I can make out, is one of the few cynics in the arena, an amiable, large-limbed park ranger named Jim, who sporadically leaps to his feet to shout, "I'm so motivated!" in tones laden with sarcasm. He explains that he was required to attend by his employer, the United States National Park Service, though when I ask why that organization might wish its rangers to use paid work time in this fashion, he cheerily concedes that he has no fucking clue. Dr. Schuller's sermon, meanwhile, is gathering pace. "When I was a child, it was impossible for a man ever to walk on the moon, impossible to cut out a human heart and put it in another man's chest. The word impossible has proven to be a very stupid word." He doesn't spend much time marshalling further evidence for his assertion that failure is optional. It's clear that Schuller, the author of Move Ahead with Possibility Thinking and Tough Times Never Last But Tough People Do, vastly prefers inspiration to argument. But in any case, he is really only a warm-up man for the day's main speakers, and within 15 minutes he's striding away to adulation and fireworks, fists clenched victoriously up at the audience, the picture of positive thinking success. It's only months later, back at my home in New York, reading the headlines over morning coffee, that I learn the news that the largest church in the United States constructed entirely from glass has filed for bankruptcy, a word Dr. Schuller had apparently neglected to eliminate from his vocabulary. For a civilization so fixated on achieving happiness, we seem remarkably incompetent at the task. One of the best-known general findings of the science of happiness has been the discovery that the countless advantages of modern life have done so little to lift our collective mood. The awkward truth seems to be that increased economic growth does not necessarily make for happier societies, just as increased personal income above a certain basic level doesn't make for happier people. Nor does better education, at least according to some studies. Nor does an increased choice of consumer products. Nor do bigger and fancier homes, which instead seem mainly to provide the privilege of more space in which to feel gloomy. Perhaps you don't need telling that self-help books, the modern-day apotheosis of the quest for happiness, are among the things that fail to make us happy. But for the record, research strongly suggests that they are rarely much help. This is why, amongst themselves, some self-help publishers refer to the 18-month rule, which states that the person most likely to purchase any given self-help book is someone who, within the previous 18 months, purchased a self-help book, one that evidently didn't solve all their problems. When you look at the self-help shelves with a coldly impartial eye, this isn't especially surprising. That we yearn for neat, book-sized solutions to the problems of being human is understandable, but strip away the packaging, and you'll find that the messages of such works are frequently banal. The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People essentially tells you to decide what matters most to you in life, and then do it. How to Win Friends and Influence People advises its readers to be pleasant rather than obnoxious, and to use people's first names a lot. One of the most successful management manuals of the last few years, FISH, which is intended to help foster happiness and productivity in the workplace, suggests handing out small toy fish to your hardest working employees. As we'll see, when the messages get more specific than that, self-help gurus tend to make claims that simply aren't supported by more reputable research. The evidence suggests, for example, that venting your anger doesn't get rid of it, while visualizing your goals doesn't seem to make you more likely to achieve them. And whatever you make of the country-by-country surveys of national happiness that are now published with some regularity, it's striking that the happiest countries are never those where self-help books sell the most, nor indeed where professional psychotherapists are most widely consulted. The existence of a thriving happiness industry clearly isn't sufficient to engender national happiness, and it's not unreasonable to suspect that it might make matters worse. Yet the ineffectiveness of modern strategies for happiness is really just a small part of the problem. There are good reasons to believe that the whole notion of seeking happiness is flawed to begin with. For one thing, who says happiness is a valid goal in the first place? Religions have never placed much explicit emphasis on it, at least as far as this world is concerned. Philosophers have certainly not been unanimous in endorsing it either. And any evolutionary psychologist will tell you that evolution has little interest in your being happy, beyond trying to make sure that you're not so listless or miserable that you lose the will to reproduce. Even assuming happiness to be a worthy target, though, a worse pitfall awaits, which is that aiming for it seems to reduce your chances of ever attaining it. Ask yourself whether you're happy, observed the philosopher John Stuart Mill, and you cease to be so. At best, it would appear, happiness can only be glimpsed out of the corner of an eye, not stared at directly. We tend to remember having been happy in the past much more frequently than we are conscious of being happy in the present. Making matters worse still, what happiness actually is feels impossible to define in words. Even supposing you could do so, you'd presumably end up with as many different definitions as there are people on the planet. All of which means it's tempting to conclude that how can we be happy is simply the wrong question, that we might as well resign ourselves to never finding the answer and get on with something more productive instead. But could there be a third possibility? Besides the futile effort to pursue solutions that never seem to work, on the one hand, and just giving up, on the other. After several years reporting on the field of psychology as a journalist, I finally realized that there might be. I began to think that something united all those psychologists and philosophers, and even the occasional self-help guru, whose ideas seemed actually to hold water. The startling conclusion at which they had all arrived, in different ways, was this: that the effort to try to feel happy is often precisely the thing that makes us miserable, and that it is our constant efforts to eliminate the negative, insecurity, uncertainty, failure, or sadness, that is what causes us to feel so insecure, anxious, uncertain, or unhappy. They didn't see this conclusion as depressing, though. Instead, they argued that it pointed to an alternative approach, a negative path to happiness, that entailed taking a radically different stance towards those things that most of us spend our lives trying hard to avoid. It involved learning to enjoy uncertainty, embracing insecurity, stopping trying to think positively, becoming familiar with failure, even learning to value death. In short, all these people seemed to agree that in order to be truly happy, we might actually need to be willing to experience more negative emotions, or at the very least, to learn to stop running quite so hard from them. Which is a bewildering thought, and one that calls into question not just our methods for achieving happiness, but also our assumptions about what happiness really means. These days, this notion certainly gets less press than the admonition to remain positive at all times, but it's a viewpoint with a surprisingly long and respectable history. You'll find it in the works of the Stoic philosophers of ancient Greece and Rome, who emphasized the benefits of always contemplating how badly things might go. It lies deep near the core of Buddhism, which counsels that true security lies in the unrestrained embrace of insecurity, in the recognition that we never really stand on solid ground, and never can. It underpins the medieval tradition of memento mori, which celebrated the life-giving benefits of never forgetting about death. And it's what connects New Age writers, such as the best-selling spiritual teacher Eckhart Tolle, with more mainstream recent work in cognitive psychology on the self-defeating nature of positive thinking. This same negative approach to happiness also helps explain why so many people find mindfulness meditation so beneficial, why a new generation of business thinkers are advising companies to drop their obsession with goal-setting and embrace uncertainty instead, and why, in recent years, some psychologists have reached the conclusion that pessimism may often be as healthy and productive as optimism. At the bottom of all this lies the principle that the countercultural philosopher of the 1950s and 60s, Alan Watts, echoing Aldous Huxley, labelled the law of reversed effort, or the backwards law. the notion that in all sorts of contexts, from our personal lives to politics, all this trying to make everything right is a big part of what's wrong. Or to quote Watts, that when you try to stay on the surface of the water, you sink, but when you try to sink, you float, and that insecurity is the result of trying to be secure. In many cases, wrote Huxley, the harder we try with the conscious will to do something, the less we shall succeed. The negative path to happiness is not an argument for bloody-minded contrarianism at all costs. You won't do yourself any favours by walking into the path of oncoming buses, say, rather than trying to avoid them. Nor should it be taken as implying that there's necessarily anything wrong with optimism. A more useful way to think of it is as a much-needed counterweight to a culture fixated on the notion that optimism and positivity are the only possible paths to happiness. Of course, many of us are already healthily sceptical when it comes to positive thinking. But it's worth noting that even most people who disdain the cult of optimism, as the philosopher Peter Venezzi calls it, end up subtly endorsing it. They assume that since they cannot or will not subscribe to its ideology, their only alternative is to resign themselves to gloom, or a sort of ironic curmudgeonhood, instead. The negative path is about rejecting this dichotomy and seeking instead the happiness that arises through negativity, rather than trying to drown negativity out with relentless good cheer. If a fixation on positivity is the disease, this approach is the antidote. This negative path, it should be emphasized, isn't one single, comprehensive, neatly packaged philosophy. The antidote is not a panacea. Part of the problem with positive thinking and many related approaches to happiness is exactly this desire to reduce big questions to one-size-fits-all self-help tricks or 10-point plans. By contrast, the negative path offers no such single solution. Some of its proponents stress embracing negative feelings and thoughts, while others might better be described as advocating indifference towards them. Some focus on radically unconventional techniques for pursuing happiness, while others point towards a different definition of happiness, or to abandoning the pursuit of it altogether. The word negative often has a double meaning here, too. It can refer to unpleasant experiences and emotions, but some philosophies of happiness are best described as negative because they involve developing skills of not doing, of learning not to chase positive feelings so aggressively. There are many paradoxes here, and they only get deeper the more you probe. For example, is a feeling or a situation truly negative if it leads ultimately to happiness? If being positive doesn't make you happy, is it right to call it being positive at all? If you redefine happiness to accommodate negativity, is it still happiness? And so on. None of these questions can be tidily resolved. This is partly because the proponents of the negative path share only a general way of seeing life, rather than a single strict set of beliefs. But it's also because one crucial foundation of their approach is precisely that happiness involves paradoxes, that there is no way to tie up all the loose ends, however desperately we might want to. This book is the record of a journey through the world of the backwards law, and of the people, living and dead, who have followed the negative path to happiness. My travels took me to the remote woodlands of Massachusetts, where I spent a week on a silent meditation retreat, to Mexico, where death is not shunned but celebrated, and to the desperately impoverished slums outside Nairobi, where insecurity is the unignorable reality of everyday life. I met modern-day Stoics, specialists in the art of failure, professional pessimists, and other advocates of the power of negative thinking, many of whom proved surprisingly jolly. But I began in San Antonio because I wanted to experience the cult of optimism at its most extreme. If it was true, as I'd come to believe, that Dr. Robert Schuller's flavour of positive thinking was really only an exaggerated version of the one-sided beliefs we all tend to hold about happiness, then it made sense, first of all, to witness the problem at its purest. Which is how I came to find myself rising reluctantly to my feet up in the dark extremity of that basketball stadium, because Get Motivated's excitable mistress of ceremonies had announced a dance competition in which everyone present was obliged to participate. Giant beach balls appeared as if from nowhere, bumping across the heads of the crowd who jiggled awkwardly as Wham! Blared from the sound system. The first prize of a free trip to Disney World, we were informed, awaited not the best dancer, but the most motivated one, though the distinction made little difference to me. I found the whole thing too excruciating to do more than sway very slightly. The prize was eventually awarded to a soldier. This was a decision that I suspected had been taken to pander to local patriotic pride, rather than strictly in recognition of highly motivated dancing. After the competition, during a break in proceedings prior to George Bush's arrival, I left the main stadium to buy an overpriced hot dog and found myself in conversation with a fellow attendee, an elegantly dressed retired schoolteacher from San Antonio, who introduced herself as Helen. Money was tight, she explained when I asked why she was attending. She had reluctantly concluded that she needed to come out of retirement and get back to work, and she'd been hoping that Get Motivated might motivate her. The thing is, though, she said, as we chatted about the speakers we'd seen, it's kind of hard to think these good thoughts all the time like they tell you, isn't it? For a moment, she looked stricken. Then she recovered, wagging a teacherly finger as if to tell herself off. But you're not supposed to think like that. One of the foremost investigators of the problems with positive thinking is a professor of psychology named Daniel Wegner, who runs the Mental Control Laboratory at Harvard University. This is not, whatever its name might suggest, a CIA-funded establishment dedicated to the science of brainwashing. Wegner's intellectual territory is what has come to be known as ironic process theory, which explores the ways in which our efforts to suppress certain thoughts or behaviours result, ironically, in their becoming more prevalent. I got off to a bad start with Professor Wegner when I accidentally typed his surname in a newspaper column as Wenger. He sent me a crabby email, get the name right, and didn't seem likely to be receptive to the argument that my slip-up was an interesting example of exactly the kinds of errors he studied. The rest of our communications proved a little strained. The problems to which Wegner has dedicated much of his career all have their origins in a simple and intensely irritating parlour game, which dates back at least to the days of Fyodor Dostoevsky, who reputedly used it to torment his brother. It takes the form of a challenge. Can you, the victim is asked, succeed in not thinking about a white bear for one whole minute? You can guess the answer, of course, but it's nonetheless instructive to make the attempt. Why not try it now? Look at your watch, or find a clock with a second hand, and aim for a mere 10 seconds of entirely non-white bear-related thoughts, starting now. My commiserations on your failure. Wegner's earliest investigations of ironic process theory involved little more than issuing this challenge to American university students, then asking them to speak their inner monologues aloud while they made the attempt. This is a rather crude way of accessing someone's thought processes, but an excerpt from one typical transcript nonetheless vividly demonstrates the futility of the struggle. Of course, now the only thing I'm going to think about is a white bear. Don't think about a white bear. What was I thinking about before? See, I think about flowers a lot. Okay, so my fingernails are really bad. Every time I really want, like, to talk, think, to not think about the white bear, then it makes me think about the white bear more. At this juncture, you might be beginning to wonder why it is that some social psychologists seem to be allowed to spend other people's money proving the obvious. Of course the white bear challenge is virtually impossible to win. But Wegner was just getting started. The more he explored the field, the more he came to suspect that the internal mechanism responsible for sabotaging our efforts at suppressing white bear thoughts might govern an entire territory of mental activity and outward behaviour. The white bear challenge, after all, seems like a metaphor for much of what goes wrong in life. All too often, the outcome we're seeking to avoid is exactly the one to which we seem magnetically lured. Wegner labelled this effect the precisely counterintuitive error, which, he explained in one paper, is when we manage to do the worst possible thing, the blunder so outrageous that we think about it in advance and resolve not to let that happen. We see a rut coming up in the road ahead and proceed to steer our bike right into it. We make a mental note not to mention a sore point in conversation, and then cringe in horror as we blurt out exactly that thing. We carefully cradle the glass across the room, all the while thinking, "Don't spill," and then juggle it onto the carpet under the gaze of our host. Far from representing an occasional divergence from our otherwise flawless self-control, the capacity for ironic error seems to lurk deep in the soul, close to the core of our characters. Edgar Allan Poe, in his short story of the same name, calls it the imp of the perverse, that nameless but distinct urge one sometimes experiences when walking along a precipitous cliff edge or climbing to the observation deck of a tall building to throw oneself off, not from any suicidal motivation, but precisely because it would be so calamitous to do so. The imp of the perverse plagues social interactions, too, as anyone who has ever laughed in recognition at an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm will know all too well. What's going on here, Wegener argues, is a malfunctioning of the uniquely human capacity for metacognition, or thinking about thinking. Metacognition, Wegener explains, occurs when thought takes itself as an object. Mainly, it's an extremely useful skill. It's what enables us to recognize when we're being unreasonable, or sliding into depression, or being afflicted by anxiety, and then to do something about it. But when we use metacognitive thoughts directly to try to control our other, everyday, object-level thoughts, by suppressing images of white bears, say, or replacing gloomy thoughts with happy ones, we run into trouble. Meta-thoughts are instructions we give ourselves about our object-level thinking, as Wegener puts it, and sometimes we just can't follow our own instructions. When you try not to think of a white bear, you may experience some success in forcing alternative thoughts into your mind. At the same time, though, a metacognitive monitoring process will crank into action to scan your mind for evidence of whether you're succeeding or failing at the task. And this is where things get perilous, because if you try too hard, or, Wegener's studies suggest, if you're tired, stressed, depressed, attempting to multitask, or otherwise suffering from mental load, metacognition will frequently go wrong. The monitoring process will start to occupy more than its fair share of limelight on the cognitive stage. It will jump to the forefront of consciousness. And suddenly, all you'll be able to think about is white bears, and how badly you're doing at not thinking about them. Could it be that ironic process theory also sheds light on what is wrong with our efforts to achieve happiness, and on the way that our efforts to feel positive seem so frequently to bring about the opposite result? In the years since Wegener's earliest white bear experiments, his research, and that of others, has turned up more and more evidence to support that notion. One example, when experimental subjects are told of an unhappy event, but then instructed to try not to feel sad about it, they end up feeling worse than people who are informed of the event, but given no instructions about how to feel. In another study, when patients who were suffering from panic disorders listened to relaxation tapes, their hearts beat faster than patients who listened to audiobooks with no explicitly relaxing content. Bereaved people who make the most effort to avoid feeling grief, research suggests, take the longest to recover from their loss. Our efforts at mental suppression fail in the sexual arena, too. People instructed not to think about sex exhibit greater arousal, as measured by the electrical conductivity of their skin, than those not instructed to suppress such thoughts. Seen from this perspective, swathes of the self-help industry's favourite techniques for achieving happiness and success, from positive thinking to visualising your goals to getting motivated, stand revealed to be suffering from one enormous flaw. A person who has resolved to think positive must constantly scan his or her mind for negative thoughts. There's no other way that the mind could ever gauge its success at the operation. Yet that scanning will draw attention to the presence of negative thoughts. Worse, if the negative thoughts start to predominate, a vicious spiral may kick in, since the failure to think positively may become the trigger for a new stream of self-berating thoughts about not thinking positively enough. Suppose you decide to follow Dr. Schuller's suggestion and try to eliminate the word impossible from your vocabulary, or more generally try to focus exclusively on successful outcomes and stop thinking about things not working out. As we'll see, there are all sorts of problems with this approach. But the most basic one is that you may well fail as a result of the very act of monitoring your success. This problem of self-sabotage through self-monitoring is not the only hazard of positive thinking. An additional twist was revealed in 2009 when a psychologist based in Canada named Joanne Wood set out to test the effectiveness of affirmations, those peppy self-congratulatory phrases designed to lift the user's mood through repetition. Affirmations have their origins in the work of the 19th century French pharmacist Émile Coué, a forerunner of the contemporary positive thinkers, who coined the one that remains the most famous. Every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better. Most affirmations sound pretty cheesy, and one might suspect that they would have little effect. Surely, though, they're harmless. Wood wasn't so sure about that. Her reasoning, though compatible with Wegener's, drew on a different psychological tradition, known as self-comparison theory. Much as we like to hear positive messages about ourselves, this theory suggests, we crave even more strongly the sense of being a coherent, consistent self in the first place. Messages that conflict with that existing sense of self, therefore, are unsettling, and so we often reject them, even if they happen to be positive, and even if the source of the message is ourselves. Wood's hunch was that people who seek out affirmations would be, by definition, those with low self-esteem, but that for that very same reason, they would end up reacting against the messages in the affirmations because they conflicted with their self-images. Messages such as, every day in every way I'm getting better and better, would clash with their poor opinion of themselves and thus be rejected so as not to threaten the coherence of their sense of self. The result might even be a worsening of their low self-esteem as people struggled to reassert their existing self-images against the incoming messages. Which is exactly what happened in Wood's research. In one set of experiments, people were divided into subgroups of those with low and high self-esteem, then asked to undertake a journal writing exercise. Every time a bell rang, they were to repeat to themselves the phrase, "I am a lovable person." According to a variety of ingenious mood measures, those who began the process with low self-esteem became appreciably less happy as a result of telling themselves that they were lovable. They didn't feel particularly lovable to begin with, and trying to convince themselves otherwise merely solidified their negativity. Positive thinking had made them feel worse. The arrival of George Bush on stage in San Antonio was heralded by the sudden appearance of his Secret Service detail. These were men who would probably have stood out anywhere in their dark suits and earpieces, but who stood out twice as prominently at Get Motivated thanks to their rigid frowns. The job of protecting former presidents from potential assassins, it appeared, wasn't one that rewarded looking on the bright side and assuming nothing could go wrong. Bush himself, by contrast, bounded on stage, grinning. "You know, retirement ain't so bad, especially when you get to retire to Texas," he began, before launching into a speech he'd evidently delivered several times before. First, he told a folksy anecdote about spending his post-presidency cleaning up after his dog. "I was picking up that which I had been dodging for 8 years." Then, for a strange moment or two, it seemed as if the main topic of his speech would be how he once had to choose a rug for the Oval Office. "I thought to myself, the presidency is going to be a decision-making experience." But his real subject, it soon emerged, was optimism. "I don't believe you can lead a family, or a school, or a city, or a state, or a country, unless you're optimistic that the future is going to be better," he said. "And I want you to know that even in the darkest days of my presidency, I was optimistic that the future was going to be better than the past for our citizens and the world." You need not hold any specific political opinion about the 43rd President of the United States to see how his words illustrate a fundamental strangeness of the cult of optimism. Bush was not ignoring the numerous controversies of his administration, the strategy one might have imagined he would adopt at a motivational seminar before a sympathetic audience and facing no risk of hostile questions. Instead, he had chosen to redefine them as evidence in support of his optimistic attitude. The way Bush saw it, the happy and successful periods of his presidency proved the benefits of an optimistic outlook, of course. But so did the unhappy and unsuccessful ones. When things are going badly, after all, you need optimism all the more. Or to put it another way, once you've resolved to embrace the ideology of positive thinking, you'll find a way to interpret virtually any eventuality as a justification for thinking positively. You need never spend time considering how your actions might go wrong. Could this curiously unfalsifiable ideology of positivity at all costs, positivity regardless of the results, be actively dangerous? Opponents of the Bush administration's foreign policies might have reason to think so. This is also one part of the case made by the social critic Barbara Ehrenreich in her 2009 book Brightsided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America. One underappreciated cause of the global financial crisis of the late 2000s, she argues, was an American business culture in which even thinking about the possibility of failure, let alone speaking up about it at meetings, had come to be considered an embarrassing faux pas. Bankers, their narcissism stoked by a culture that rewarded grand ambition above all, lost the capacity to distinguish between their ego-fueled dreams and concrete results. Meanwhile, homebuyers assumed that whatever they wanted could be theirs if they wanted it badly enough. How many of them had read books such as The Secret, which makes exactly that claim, and accordingly sought mortgages they were unable to repay? Irrational optimism suffused the financial sector, and the professional purveyors of optimism, the speakers and self-help gurus and seminar organisers, were only too happy to encourage it. To the extent that positive thinking had become a business in itself, writes Ehrenreich, business was its principal client, eagerly consuming the good news that all things are possible through an effort of mind. This was a useful message for employees, who by the turn of the 21st century were being required to work longer hours for fewer benefits and diminishing job security. But it was also a liberating ideology for top-level executives. What was the point in agonizing over balance sheets and tedious analyses of risks? And why bother worrying about dizzying levels of debt and exposure to potential defaults when all good things come to those who are optimistic enough to expect them? Ehrenreich traces the origins of this philosophy to 19th century America, and specifically to the quasi-religious movement known as New Thought. New Thought arose in rebellion against the dominant gloomy message of American Calvinism, which was that relentless hard work was the duty of every Christian, with the additional sting that, thanks to the doctrine of predestination, you might in any case already be marked to spend eternity in hell. New Thought, by contrast, proposed that one could achieve happiness and worldly success through the power of the mind. This mind power could even cure physical ailments, according to the newly minted religion of Christian Science, which grew directly from the same roots. Yet, as Ehrenreich makes clear, New Thought imposed its own kind of harsh judgmentalism, replacing Calvinism's obligatory hard work with obligatory positive thinking. Negative thoughts were fiercely denounced, a message that echoed the old religion's condemnation of sin and added an insistence on the constant interior labour of self-examination. Quoting the sociologist Mickey McGee, Ehrenreich shows how, under this new orthodoxy of optimism, continuous and never-ending work on the self was offered not only as a road to success, but also to a kind of secular salvation. George Bush, then, was standing in a venerable tradition when he proclaimed the importance of optimism in all circumstances. But his speech at Get Motivated was over almost as soon as it had started. A dash of religion, a singularly unilluminating anecdote about the terrorist attacks of September 11th, some words of praise for the military, and he was waving goodbye. "Thank you, Texas, it's good to be home," as his bodyguards closed in around him. Beneath the din of cheering, I heard Jim, the park ranger in the next seat, emit a sigh of relief. "Okay, I'm motivated now," he muttered to nobody in particular. "Is it time for some beer?" There are lots of ways of being miserable, says a character in a short story by Edith Wharton, but there's only one way of being comfortable, and that is to stop running around after happiness. This observation pungently expresses the problem with the cult of optimism, the ironic, self-defeating struggle that sabotages positivity when we try too hard. But it also hints at the possibility of a more hopeful alternative, an approach to happiness that might take a radically different form. The first step is to learn how to stop chasing positivity so intently. But many of the proponents of the negative path to happiness take things further still, arguing, paradoxically but persuasively, that deliberately plunging more deeply into what we think of as negative may be a precondition of true happiness. Perhaps the most vivid metaphor for this whole strange philosophy is a small children's toy known as the Chinese finger trap, though the evidence suggests it's probably not Chinese in origin at all. In his office at the University of Nevada, the psychologist Stephen Hayes, an outspoken critic of counterproductive positive thinking, keeps a box of them on his desk. He uses them to illustrate his arguments. The trap is a tube made of thin strips of woven bamboo, with the opening at each end being roughly the size of a human finger. The unwitting victim is asked to insert his index fingers into the tube, then finds himself trapped. In reaction to his efforts to pull his fingers out again, the openings at each end of the tube constrict, gripping his fingers ever more tightly. The harder he pulls, the more decisively he's trapped. It's only by relaxing his efforts at escape, and by pushing his fingers further in, that he can widen the ends of the tube, whereupon it falls away, and he's free. In the case of the Chinese finger trap, Hayes observes, doing the presumably sensible thing is counterproductive. Following the negative path to happiness is about doing the other thing, the presumably illogical thing, instead. Chapter 2. What Would Seneca Do? The Stoic Art of Confronting the Worst-Case Scenario. Pessimism, when you get used to it, is just as agreeable as optimism. Arnold Bennett, Things That Have Interested Me. It's an ordinary spring morning on the central line of the London Underground, which is to say that there are the usual minor delays to the service, and a major sense of despair emanating from the closely packed commuters. The only extraordinary thing is that I'm a few moments from undergoing, entirely voluntarily, what I expect to be one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. As we approach Chancery Lane Station, but before the automated voice on the public address system announces this fact, I plan to break the silence and proclaim loudly the words Chancery Lane. As the train continues to Holborn, Tottenham Court Road, Oxford Circus and beyond, it's my intention to keep this up, announcing the name of each station as we go. I'm aware that this is not the most frightening exploit imaginable. Readers with experience of having been taken hostage by pirates, or buried alive, or even just having endured a particularly turbulent airplane journey, for that matter, could be forgiven for finding this all rather self-dramatizing. Yet the fact remains that my palms are sweating and my heartbeat is accelerating. I've never handled embarrassment well, and now I'm berating myself for ever having thought that deliberately courting it might be a clever idea. I'm conducting this ritual of deliberate self-humiliation on the instructions of a modern-day psychologist, Albert Ellis, who died in 2007. But he designed it to provide a vivid demonstration of an ancient philosophy, that of the Stoics, who were among the first to suggest that the path to happiness might depend on negativity. Ellis recommended the subway station exercise, originally prescribed to his therapy patients in New York, as a way of demonstrating how irrationally we approach even mildly unpleasant experiences, and how we might find unforeseen benefits lurking within them if only we could bring ourselves to look. Stoicism, which was born in Greece and matured in Rome, shouldn't be confused with stoicism as the word is commonly used today, a weary, uncomplaining resignation that better describes the attitude of my fellow passengers on the underground. Real stoicism is far more tough-minded and involves developing a kind of muscular calm in the face of trying circumstances. This is also the purpose of Ellis's excruciating exercise, which is intended to bring me face to face with all my unspoken beliefs about embarrassment, self-consciousness, and what other people might think about me. It will force me to experience the unpleasantness that I'm fearing, and thereby to realize something about the situation that is psychologically intriguing, that my beliefs about how staggeringly awful it's going to be, when they're brought out into the open and examined, just don't seem to match the facts. Unless you are an unusually unembarrassable person, you can probably empathize with the apprehension I'm feeling. Yet when you think about it, there's something bizarre about having any negative feelings whatsoever in this situation. After all, I know nobody in the carriage personally, so I have nothing to lose from them thinking that I'm crazy. Moreover, I know from past experience on the underground that when other people start talking out loud to themselves, I ignore them, as does everyone else. This is almost certainly the worst that's going to happen to me. And those other people speaking out loud are often talking gibberish, whereas I'm going to be announcing the names of the stations. You could almost argue that I'm performing a public service. Certainly, it will be much less irritating than all the leaking iPod headphones in my vicinity. And so why, as the train begins to slow, almost indetectably at first, for the approach to Chancery Lane, do I feel as if I want to vomit? Behind many of the most popular approaches to happiness is the simple philosophy of focusing on things going right. In the world of self-help, the most overt expression of this outlook is the technique known as positive visualization. If you mentally picture things turning out well, the reasoning goes, they're far more likely to do so. The fashionable New Age concept of the law of attraction takes things a step further, suggesting that visualization may be the only thing you need in order to attain riches, great relationships, and good health. There is a deep tendency in human nature to become precisely what you visualize yourself as being, said Norman Vincent Peale, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking, in a speech he gave to executives of the investment bank Merrill Lynch in the mid-1980s. If you see yourself as tense and nervous and frustrated, that assuredly is what you will be. If you see yourself as inferior in any way, and you hold that image in your conscious mind, it will presently, by the process of intellectual osmosis, sink into the unconscious, and you will be what you visualize. If, on the contrary, you see yourself as organized, controlled, studious, a thinker, a worker, believing in your talent and ability and yourself, that is what you will become. Merrill Lynch collapsed in the financial meltdown of 2008 and had to be rescued by Bank of America. Readers are invited to draw their own conclusions. Even most people who scoff at Peel's homilies, though, might find it hard to argue with the underlying outlook, that being optimistic about the future, when you can manage it, is generally for the best. And focusing on how you hope things will turn out, rather than how you hope they won't, seems like a sensible way of motivating yourself and of maximizing your chances of success. Walking into a job interview, you're surely better off to err on the side of assuming you can triumph. As you prepare to ask someone on a date, it's surely advisable to operate on the basis that she or he might actually say yes. Indeed, a tendency to look on the bright side may be so intertwined with human survival that evolution has skewed us that way. In her 2011 book, The Optimism Bias, the neuroscientist Tali Sharot compiles growing evidence that a well-functioning mind may be built so as to perceive the odds of things going well as greater than they really are. Healthy and happy people, research suggests, generally have a less accurate, overly optimistic grasp of their true ability to influence events than do those who are suffering from depression. Yet, there are problems with this outlook, aside from just feeling disappointed when things don't turn out well. These are particularly acute in the case of positive visualization. Over the last few years, the German-born psychologist Gabrielle Oettingen and her colleagues have constructed a series of experiments designed to unearth the truth about positive fantasies about the future. The results are striking. Spending time and energy thinking about how well things could go, it has emerged, actually reduces most people's motivation to achieve them. Experimental subjects who were encouraged to think about how they were going to have a particularly high-achieving week at work, for example, ended up achieving less than those who were invited to reflect on the coming week, but given no further guidelines on how to do so. In one ingenious experiment, Oettingen had some of the participants rendered mildly dehydrated. They were then taken through an exercise that involved visualizing drinking a refreshing, icy glass of water, while others took part in a different exercise. The dehydrated water visualizers, contrary to the self-help doctrine of motivation through visualization, experienced a significant reduction in their energy levels, as measured by blood pressure. Far from becoming more motivated to hydrate themselves, their bodies relaxed, as if their thirst were already quenched. In experiment after experiment, people responded to positive visualization by relaxing. They seemed, subconsciously, to have confused visualizing success with having already achieved it. It doesn't necessarily follow, of course, that it would be a better idea to switch to negative visualization instead, and start focusing on all the ways in which things could go wrong. Yet that is precisely one of the conclusions that emerges from Stoicism, a school of philosophy that originated in Athens a few years after the death of Aristotle, and that came to dominate Western thinking about happiness for nearly five centuries. The first Stoic, so far as we know, was Zeno of Citium, born in what is now Larnaca, on the southern shores of Cyprus, sometime around 334 BC. "He had his head naturally bent on one side," writes the 3rd century Greek historian Diogenes Laertius in his Lives and Opinions of Eminent Philosophers, which is the primary source of evidence for the early Stoics. "He was thin, very tall, of a dark complexion, with flabby, weak legs, and he was very fond, as it is said, of figs, both fresh and dried in the sun." According to legend, Zeno was a merchant who came to Athens aged around 30, possibly after the traumatizing experience of being shipwrecked. There, he began to study under the Cynic philosopher Crates. Laertius relates one of Zeno's early experiences at the hands of Crates, which may help explain Stoicism's focus on irrational beliefs as the source of emotional distress. According to the story, Crates gave Zeno a bowl of lentil porridge and demanded that he carry it through the streets of Athens, but then Crates smashed the bowl with his stick, causing the contents to splatter all over Zeno's body. "The porridge ran all down his legs," Laertius tells us, whereupon Zeno ran away in embarrassment. "Why do you run away when you've done no harm?" Crates called after him teasingly, mocking Zeno's belief that he had grounds for feeling ashamed. When Zeno began to teach philosophy himself, he did so under the Stoa Poikile, the painted porch on the north side of the ancient agora of Athens, hence the label Stoic. The school's influence subsequently spread to Rome, and it's these later Roman Stoics, above all Epictetus, Seneca the Younger, and Marcus Aurelius, whose works have survived. From their earliest days, Stoic teachings emphasized the fundamental importance of reason. Nature had bestowed uniquely upon humans, the Stoics argued, the capacity to reason, and therefore a virtuous life, meaning a life proper and fitting to a human, entailed living in accordance with reason. The Roman Stoics added a psychological twist. Living virtuously in accordance with reason, they argued, would lead to inner tranquility. A state of mind, writes the scholar of Stoicism William Irvine, marked by the absence of negative emotions, such as grief, anger, and anxiety, and the presence of positive emotions, such as joy. And here lies the essential difference between Stoicism and the modern-day cult of optimism. For the Stoics, the ideal state of mind was tranquility, not the excitable cheer that positive thinkers usually seem to mean when they use the word happiness. And tranquility was to be achieved not by strenuously chasing after enjoyable experiences, but by cultivating a kind of calm indifference towards one's circumstances. One way to do this, the Stoics argued, was by turning towards negative emotions and experiences, not shunning them, but examining them closely instead. If this focus on negativity seems perverse, it may help to consider the life circumstances of the Stoics themselves. Epictetus was born into slavery in what is now Turkey. Though later freed, he died crippled as a result of his master's brutal treatment. Seneca, by contrast, was the son of a nobleman and enjoyed a stellar career as a personal tutor to the Roman emperor. But that ended abruptly when his employer, who unfortunately was the deranged Nero, suspected Seneca of plotting against him and ordered him to commit suicide. There seems to have been little evidence for Nero's suspicions, but by that point he had already murdered his mother and stepbrother and gained a reputation for burning Christians in his gardens after dark to provide a source of light, so he can hardly be accused of acting out of character. Seneca, the story goes, tried to do as he was told by cutting open his veins to bleed himself to death, but he failed to die and so asked to be fed poison. This, too, failed to kill him. It was only when he took a suffocatingly steamy bath that he finally expired. Perhaps it's unsurprising that a philosophy emerging from such circumstances as Epictetus's, or in a context where a fate such as Seneca's awaited even those of noble birth if their luck ran out, would not incline towards positive thinking. Where was the merit in trying to convince yourself that things would turn out for the best when there was so much evidence that they might not? Yet it's a curious truth that the Stoics' approach to happiness through negativity begins with exactly the kind of insight that Norman Vincent Peale might endorse, but when it comes to feeling upbeat or despondent, it's our beliefs that really matter. Most of us, the Stoics point out, go through life under the delusion that it's certain people, situations, or events that make us sad, anxious, or angry. When you're irritated by a colleague at the next desk who won't stop talking, you naturally assume that the colleague is the source of the irritation. When you hear that a beloved relative is ill and feel pain for them, it makes sense to think of the illness as the source of the pain. Look closely at your experience, though, say the Stoics, and you'll eventually be forced to conclude that neither of these external events is negative in itself.